Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Trupanion, medical insurance for the life of your pet, is a proud sponsor of Pure Dog Talk. Trupanion invites you to sign up for their breeder support program. This program lets breeders provide their buyers with special offers to help protect their puppy in the event any unexpected accidents or illnesses happen to this puppy as they're transitioning into their new home. To date, Trupanion has paid over $1 million in claims to pets protected with this special offer. Sign up from our partner page today and start sending your own litters home protected. Don't forget to mention Pure Dog Talk sent you. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves, and I am thrilled. We have a very special guest with us today. This is a listener request from almost 2 years ago now that I just finally was able to pull together, and I am thrilled to be joined by John Buddy. He is the breeder and the mastermind of Tartan Sight Collies. He is an AKC judge, and he brings fully a half a century of breeding knowledge to the conversation. So in terms of our master breeders, I am thrilled to be joined by Mr. Buddy. So thank you, John. Thanks for joining us.
No, thank you for inviting me.
So we like to do the 411 here on this show. So tell us a little bit about how you got started. What brought you to dogs? What brought you to collies? And when was that?
Well, we always had a collie in our household. My grandfather was a Scottish immigrant and would have nothing but collies, I guess, throughout his lifetime. Mm. And my father bred white collies for a while. He had two litters. And I was puttering around in our basement, going through an old steamer trunk that my grandparents had brought with them. And inside was a picture of a white collie. And in the frame was a little yellow dog show ribbon from the Bloomingdale's dog show in New York City that the collie had won. And at that particular time, I really didn't know much about any of that. So, of course, I ployed my father with all kinds of questions and everything else to find out about it. He wasn't really serious about it. You know, it was just something he did as a youngster, but it sort of intrigued me and made me want to go more. So I spent several weeks after that at the local pet shop looking into Dog World magazines and some other things, and kind of got bitten by the bug and decided that someday I would like to have a collie of my own and maybe breed it.
Awesome. And so how did you acquire that first collie? I mean, were you able to find a breeder? How did that come about?
The first collie of my own came shortly after that because our family pet had passed away and actually got another pet puppy. But once I got that, I became a little more intrigued and continued to study and learn. Eventually, I subscribed to Dog World magazine and started writing to all the different breeders in there. Because I grew up in New York City as well, and I was able to get a little 15-cent token, which would take me into the American Kennel Club, and I began to spend a lot of time during the summer going there and making use of the library.
Wow.
Eventually, you know, I picked out a family of dogs that I liked and wrote to the breeder, got introduced and everything, and bought my first show puppy, and it also turned out to be my first champion. But through that breeder, who was Patricia Starkweather, I learned a lot. And Pat also wrote the collie column for Dog World.
Right.
And this would have been in the very early 1960s.
Right. And so, I mean, just a beautiful segue into what we think of as traditional mentorship, right? That growing
Absolutely.
Up. Right. And that we, I think, kind of to a degree have lost somewhat today compared to what you're describing to what I grew up, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s. So maybe just could you touch a little bit on some of that mentorship and how she helped you learn?
Back then, long distance phone calls were pretty expensive. We didn't have, you know, the things available that we do today. We didn't have the computer or anything else. So a great deal was done through letter writing. Pat had also written the book All About Collies, which was reprinted like 3 or 4 times. And, you know, that became somewhat of a Bible to me and the first books that I read. But it was the letter writing, and they would be, you know, long and informative. And I still remember the letterhead that she used was on an onion skin paper, which I just thought was like the classiest thing ever.
Right.
And in the upper left-hand corner was a head study of one of her famous champions, Glenn Hillenper Jones. And I saved those for years and years and years, and it was only in the last move that somehow they got lost. But, you know, I collected them all and put them in a book. You know, I would ask questions and get them answered. The other thing was that Pat lived in Pennsylvania on the suburbs of Philadelphia, and I was still in New York City. But my parents, after we got the puppy, they would drive me down and they would go off on a weekend, and I got to stay with Pat and do kennel chores and brush dogs and, you know, kind of learn very much hands-on. The thing that I was blessed with that made a big difference too was that even though I was a kid, I think she took me seriously and realized my passion even then.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you make some really good points, the hands-on point and the be taken seriously point, that you had serious interest and gave serious effort, but that you were rewarded for that. And I think those are things that all these years later, people can listen to and pay attention to and apply, right? I mean, I think that that's
well,
a big...
you know, in later years, I became a teacher, but one of the things that I used even in teaching was something that Pat Starkweather taught me early. And that is that oftentimes when I would ask a question, she would answer it with another question to me to make me think.
Right.
You know, rather than just give me a flat out answer. And I think that was really valuable.
I like that. And I think that it can be hard for us, right? Like when we're trying to help people learn, you want to just tell them.
Right.
But I think that it's so valuable to ask them their opinion and help them work through that process is not as easy, but I think it's more valuable for sure.
And more meaningful. I think spoon feeding someone an answer does not have the same impact that making somebody work hard to come up with an answer on their own.
Right. Okay. Absolutely fabulous. So I am going to go directly to the breeding rules that you shared, I'm sure some time ago with Nikki Rigsby, but I found them so profound. And so I just would like to touch on most of them. Your comment, leave the sport no worse than you found it. So talk to me about that. How do you see that applied in today's society?
I think today's society, unfortunately, has come to a point of so much instant gratification. And with that, you also have people that take so much for granted. I was always taught that we were very lucky to get involved in dogs the way that we did. And regardless of your breed, you were given the ownership and you were in charge of the maintenance of that particular breed for as long as you chose. And that so many people had put so much effort into the dogs that you were currently breeding because it came down from their breeding program.
Right.
It was important that you respected their contribution, that you continue to be mindful of breeding for the best quality, the best health, the best temperament. And that when it was time for you to exit the breeding arena, that all that was taken into consideration. And again, that you left it in as good a shape or better than the way it was handed down to you. And the same thing with the sport.
And I think that just that respect, and I know I try and pay it back to the breeders that I built my foundation on. So I think that that is something that is so important and sometimes gets lost. So
absolutely.
This is another one I really like. The number of champions finished or ribbons earned is not the true measure of being a successful breeder. This, I think, is super, super powerful and really important for people to hear. So speak to us on this a little bit.
It's very easy to be overwhelmed by numbers and statistics. And for people even new to the sport, numbers, statistics, wins sometimes have more importance than actual top quality.
Right.
There have been many, many really important contributing breeders in our sport who did so on a smaller scale, but made some huge strides or bred some really outstanding individuals that really changed the face of each breed. And it isn't always how many wins they got or how many champions they produced. It really has to look to quality and not just quantity. Unfortunately, sometimes people get so caught up with the numbers and everything else that it doesn't lead them in the right direction. And for every record that is achieved, you come to learn there will always be someone that can break that record.
Exactly. And I think too often people who are just getting started, it's seductive to breed to the big winner.
Absolutely.
Rather than to learn the pedigree and know what nicks well, what matches and what doesn't, you know?
Well, today I don't think people really, the art of understanding a pedigree is something that's sometimes overlooked today that shouldn't be. And I'm not just talking to the first or second generation.
Right.
I think when you go farther back and look, but then really study it, you know, who are the dogs in that pedigree? If you don't have the opportunity to see them all, which you won't, then you have to find certain people in your life that I have always called bridges. They are the bridges to the past because they can enlighten you, albeit from their perspective, about some of the dogs and the names in the pedigree. And if you are able to breed into a family that is very strong in certain characteristics, the pedigree will usually tell you which particular dogs were responsible for making those characteristics so strong because they were placed in the pedigree in a certain position and why it came about. And I think that's really important too.
It is.
As a kid, when I would go to the AKC, they used to let you use the library and you could do pedigree research using the stud books. Mm-hmm. And I remember our neighbor was a butcher and he used to bring me these big sheets of butcher paper home. And I could roll them up and take them with me on the subway and lay them out on the table. And if I had a whole day, I could do a 7 or 8 generation pedigree,
right,
which was fascinating because the other thing with the AKC is they had all kinds of historical books where I could also look up photos of
right.
some of these dogs who I only knew by name. And it was all really fascinating. And that research then leads you to look into the breeders of the past and what they accomplished, but more importantly, how they accomplished it.
Yes, all of these things. I was, as you were talking about the bridges, I was going back in my mind to my mentors, right? My people and my breed German Wirehaired Pointers.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who were founding members of the National Club and the people like that who had that history that I was able and fortunate to visit with. And I just think how valuable that was.
Mm-hmm.
Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute.
I'm so excited and I just can't hide it. Yeah, I know. I promised I was never going to sing again, but I'm saying our new audiobook is available now. Whoop! Yeah! Pure Dog Talks, How to Stack Your Dog and Other Important Talks is a 2-CD set featuring early mentoring episodes from the podcast, tips, and previously unrecorded pep talks. This is a power-packed opportunity for folks who don't want to search our exhaustive 260-some-odd episode library for just the topic they're looking for. This 2-hour series is a great resource for breeders and mentors, 4-H leaders, anybody that's looking for a straight-line trajectory from what kind of dog should I get to raising a show dog, how to stack and move with your dog, to counting championship points for your new dog. Super easy to purchase. Just drop PayPal $25 a book to Laura at puredogtalk.com and make sure audiobook is in the comments and that your mailing address is included. Because shipping is free, that's on me, and I'll have it to you in just a few days. Breeder and mentor bundles are available. I'll give you a 10% discount on 5 or more, and this is a very limited print run. So get your order in today. You may not be here tomorrow. So the next one I think that I really want to touch on, and it actually was triggered by a conversation I was having with a friend of mine, look to the grandparents, because you talk about the pedigree. You talk about where those dogs are placed in the pedigree.
Right.
So speak to that a little bit in terms of your success and what you learned over your 50 years and the value to the grandparents and just kind of where those dogs fall in the pedigree, has bearing on what comes down out of the pedigree, correct?
Yes. I think a lot of people just, you know, you have dogs that become top sires or top producing dams, and I've had several. But I believe they are just really carrying the pedigree forward
right.
from their parents. And it's not always, you know, some of your top sires, the strength comes through the dam side as
yes.
well as the sire side. You know, a good example is I've always had great luck using the maternal grandsire effect in doing breedings where you can take a bitch that you feel is real quality and breed her back to her maternal grandsire.
Mm-hmm.
And some of my best individuals have come down that way. And it's the same thing by looking at other families and other breedings and things like that. And this is why pedigree study works, that you can see in many individuals, this particular combination seemed to work really well.
Right. I've interviewed, amongst my favorite interviews, of course, Pat Trotter talking about the tail female line. And some of that is so fascinating. She was one of the very first books I ever studied and like highlighted and dog-eared, right? When I was a baby breeder, you know? But I think too that so often, and you can pitch in here, what we see from an individual mating isn't so much the parents as it is their parents.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of good individuals, you know, many times you'll do a half brother, half sister breeding.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want to double up on the strong characteristics of an individual. So, you know, it becomes their double grandchild.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay. This is another good one and kind of a nice segue from the half brother, half sister. You can never outrun a problem. And I assume you're speaking to health or temperament or structure or whatever piece it is, and that you have to sort of stand up and face it. So kind of expand on that if you would.
Today, I believe it's a little easier to rid yourself. No, it's a lot easier to rid yourself of certain problems because of all the DNA testing we've come up with.
Mm-hmm.
But those breeders that have been around the block a long time realized that wasn't always available. And you had to sit and face your problems, admit your problems, and deal with them. For me, it was progressive retinal atrophy, you
mm-hmm.
know, before we had any kind of gene markers or anything else. You could go on and run away from it by staying clear of the absolute producers of the problems, but you never knew who the carriers were.
Right.
And without knowing who the carriers are, all you have to do, especially if it is a simple recessive, is breed to a dog who shares the problem and bingo, you know,
mm-hmm.
you're back in business with the problem again. So,
right.
You know, at any given time, rather than saying this came from the father or the mother or whatever, I think it's important to just face the problem and deal with it. And sometimes that means scrapping a couple of generations of breedings in order to clear it out. But in the end, it will become a problem for you and it'll come back and haunt you.
Yeah.
And I think you need to protect your breeding program
right.
as a whole. You know, you want to... We talked earlier about leaving the breed in as good a shape as it is, and that's one way that you do it.
Yes, that rings really true to me. My bugaboo was a thyroid, so I've spent 25 years trying to get that cleared out, and so far, so good. So I
mm-hmm.
think that's really important. Here's another good one for particularly today's society, and one that I think we all struggle with, but super important. Learn to see and appreciate quality in all families. In other words, in everybody else's dogs.
Exactly. And I find that to be even more true since I started judging.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's human nature that we tend to make evaluations about dogs or families of dogs, especially when we're competitors. And suddenly when it's not a competition.
Mm-hmm.
And you're judging a dog and evaluating them and, you know, trying to sharpen your skills of observation, you realize that you weren't always as open-minded as you thought. And, you know, one of the lessons as a breeder is when you get to a certain point, you think, you know, I really wished I would have bred to a particular dog at a certain time. Because by the time the dog was either too old to breed to or had passed on, you realized it might have been a valuable asset to your breeding program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes you just run scared because you hear rumors about health issues or whatever. And the other problem that I find a lot of people do is you pigeonhole the dog. You know, you look at, say, a 10-month-old male, and in your mind, you take a picture of that dog. And that picture is then embedded in your mind as to what that dog looked like. Mm-hmm. You pigeonhole him at that stage of his life, and you never allow him to grow, mature, and improve. And a lot of times, oftentimes, they do get better, they improve. And so you miss a really golden opportunity because you're stuck with this dog who you pigeonholed.
I think that is absolutely dead on. And I think it also is instructive to exhibitors because we are, particularly in today's society, oh my God, I finished it at 6 months and 2 minutes, right? So
right.
We are so anxious to show these baby puppies that are nowhere near the quality they will be at 2 or 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm. And I think when AKC started these grand champions and everything else, I do think it was in hopes that some of these dogs that didn't really get specialed
right.
would come out of the woodwork and do it. I think it's also important why attending your breed club's national specialty is also valuable.
Absolutely.
Because a lot of times dogs that are not shown in the specials class at any other time will come out and be available at the national, and you'll have those couple of days also to get up close and personal.
Again, it's national season, right? We're here, it's September, October. It's nationals, 6 nationals a day, you know? And I mm-hmm. think that is such great advice, and I preach it like, you know, Hail Mary, man, because I really do believe that that is the only way to truly, truly understand and learn and grow in your breed.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think, at least in small number breeds, there's no way to get your hands on or your eyes on enough dogs.
Well, I also think at a national specialty, at any given time, there will be certain popular sires who are being used quite a bit.
Yep.
And those sires oftentimes just click with certain families better than others.
Mm-hmm.
And by attending a national and looking at all the puppies by one of these particular dogs, you also get to have the opportunity to find out who the dams were, what the breeding was, and find out which particular nicks work better than any other and decide whether or not that'll work for you.
And I love two things there. Like, you're one of the few people I've ever talked to, and I'm at 230 some odd of these interviews, that says that word like and uses it like I do. Like, certain families, certain lines match and certain ones don't. And I think that's super important. And it also goes back to what you were talking about earlier, pulling that forward. You got to get your eyes on these dogs. Pictures don't tell the truth. People may not know until you've had your eyes and your hands on these dogs, as many of them as possible. You don't know everything.
Right. You know, the other thing is photographs. I mean, they obviously can be manipulated today, but they show a very static side of the dog. And mm-hmm. just seeing them in person in an X pen, out
right.
being walked by their owner or in the show ring, you get to see the actual demeanor and character of that particular dog and how it relates to the breed itself. And I think that's another important aspect. We've come to a time now where everybody wants little push-button show dogs. Sometimes temperaments become a little sharp and snappy, whether or not it's correct for the breed.
Mm-hmm.
But because you can count on them to stand up and show, people like that aspect. But are you really getting the character that is most appropriate for the particular breed?
Well, and I think movement and just personality. So
right.
is it a mouthy one, right? Like
mm-hmm.
collies certainly have mouths. My breed, they have mouths. If I see a dog that stands in its pen or on its stakeout chain at the field trial and does nothing but scream its head off for 3 hours, I'm probably not as excited about that dog.
No. You know, when you go back to form follows function,
right?
You know, and is that attitude and everything even good for the function of the breed?
Correct.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here.
take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.